Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week's episode is the first of a two-part special looking at the concussion crisis which is gripping all of the world's football codes. I'm going to focus today on the history of rugby union's changing attitude towards head injuries, not least because the sight of Wales' Thomas Francis staggering around Twickenham during last month's England-Wales match after a head clash has reignited the debate about rugby's treatment of concussion. I also have to declare a personal interest in the subject. I've done historical research on concussion in rugby for Ryland's Law, the solicitors who are acting on behalf of the players who are currently taking legal action against the rugby authorities. When you look back at the history of the game over the past 50 years, the picture which emerges is that in many ways rugby union has gone backwards in its understanding of the seriousness of head injuries. Before 1975, the official governing bodies of rugby union, particularly the International Rugby Board, now known as World Rugby, and the Rugby Football Union, don't seem to have had any formal regulations dealing with concussions or other head injuries. Of course, there's anecdotal evidence about possible connections between concussion in rugby and long-term impacts on brain functioning. In 1971, for example, Peter Fallows told The Times how a blow to his head during a rugby match caused permanent scarring to his left temporal lobe, which caused his epilepsy. More generally, the idea that head clashes, especially in the scrum, could lead to punch-drunk syndrome, similar to that experienced by boxers, was a common part of rugby's oral culture. The first serious look at the long-term implications of head injuries took place as early as April 1975, when the Irish Rugby Union organised an International Congress on Injuries in Rugby Football, the first major medical conference on rugby-related injuries. Among the 69 speakers were some of rugby's leading officials, coaches and players, such as Wales and British Lions fullback Dr. J.P.R. Williams, Lions coach Carwin James, and the presidents of the RFU and the Irish Rugby Union. Indeed, many of the doctors who presented papers to the Congress were themselves former international rugby players, such as Ireland's Grand Slam winning captain Dr. Jack Kyle, British Lions captain Dr. Carl Mullen, and Welsh international and Welsh Rugby Union medical officer Jack Matthews. This was the most authoritative gathering of rugby's medical community that had ever discussed rugby injuries. Bill Dickinson, the Scottish national coach, told the conference of his worries about head injuries. "I am also concerned about head injuries," he said. "Ones of the so-called minor concussion, where there is no medical help. I think if anybody receives a head injury at all, he should not be allowed to play on. The pace of player collisions are more likely to increase, and this also gives me some concern." Peter Carey, a consultant neurosurgeon at Dublin's St Lawrence Hospital, presented a paper titled Brain Injuries in Sport, in which he stated, "The most constant feature of primary damage to the brain in blunt head injuries is injury to the nerve cells of the brain. Other primary damage results in shearing of nerve fibres, contusion of the brain and laceration of the brain. The diffuse neuronal injury and shearing of nerve fibres may not be visible to the naked eye. Even after relatively mild injuries such as a boxing knockout, many brain cells die and are never replaced. Repeated injuries of this type have a cumulative effect and are responsible for the syndrome known as punch drunk. In fact, punch drunk syndrome had first been identified in medical literature as early as 1928, while the term chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, was first developed to describe the syndrome by the British neurologist MacDonald Critchley in 1949. Geoffrey Vanderfield, a neurosurgeon and later the Australian Rugby Union's medical advisor, told the Dublin conference that a player should not be allowed to return to the game too soon after a definite concussive injury, i.e. the player who has had a severe concussion should not play for at least 3 weeks and until a medical clearance. This recommendation was adopted by the International Rugby Board in 1977 when it set up its first medical advisory committee, and it was laid out in its resolution 5.7. A player who has suffered definite concussion should not participate in any match or training session for a period of at least 3 weeks from the time of injury, and then only subject to being cleared by a proper neurological examination. A few months after the Dublin conference, in November 1975, the weekly medical journal The Lancet published an article on cumulative effects of concussion by Dorothy Gronwall and Philip Wrightson, two specialists in head trauma at Auckland Hospital's Department of Neurosurgery. This paper analysed the effects of a second concussion in 20 young adults, finding that the effects of concussion seem to be cumulative, and this has important implications for sports where concussion injury is common. The paper concluded by saying, doctors do have a duty to convince the controlling bodies and participants in sports where concussion is frequent that the effects are cumulative and that the acceptance of concussion injuries, though gallant, may be very dangerous. This concern about the long-term consequences of head injuries was shared by the RFU at this time. In August 1985, its official magazine, Rugby World and Post, said that in recent years, there has been increasing concern among involved medical workers who see the long-term effects that concussion is one of the most serious injuries that can be sustained by any participant in any sport. In October 1991, to coincide with that year's Rugby Union World Cup, the Scottish Rugby Union hosted a sports medicine conference in Edinburgh. It featured 54 speakers, including Dr. Roger Vanderfield of Sydney's North Shore Hospital, who was that year's president of the International Rugby Board. It was the biggest gathering of rugby's global medical community since the 1975 Dublin Conference. Geoffrey Vanderfield, the Australian neurotrauma specialist who spoke at that 1975 conference, reiterated the need for the 3-week stand-down period for all concussions. He said, "It has to remember that even with simple concussion, there has been evidence that neural changes might occur, and if further blows are sustained before recovery, these will have a cumulative effect. An appropriate clinical examination is the best way to assess fitness to return to competition. If there has been a previous concussion, then return to contact sport should be delayed or possibly not permitted till the following season." Vanderfield's recommendations were supported by the Scottish Rugby Union's medical advisor, Donald MacLeod of St John's Hospital, West Lothian. In a 1993 article, Risks and Injuries in Rugby Football, MacLeod stated that the essential feature with regard to mild concussion is to recognise that it is associated with brain damage. The player may appear to make a rapid and complete recovery in a very short time, but there is a sustained and ill-defined period during which the brain has a reduced ability to process information. In addition, the severity and duration of the functional impairment is increased with repeated concussions. MacLeod argued that any player having a second concussion in a single season should avoid all contact sport for 3 months. If a third concussion is sustained within the same season, he should avoid all contact sport for 6 months. 5 months after that 1991 World Cup conference, the New Zealand Federation of Sports Medicine hosted its Rugby Medicine 92 conference. It was attended by the president of the New Zealand Rugby Union, Sir Russell Pettigrew, the All Blacks team, Dr. John Mayhew, and All Blacks orthopaedic consultant, Barry Teachins. Two of the conference presentations came from Philip Wrightson and Dorothy Gronwall. Gronwall told the conference that although the 3-week stand-down rule would protect most players suffering a first concussion, between 5 and 10% of cases do not recover within this time. We know that one factor which is associated with longer than normal recovery time is a history of previous head injury. Philip Wrightson examined the long-term impact of repeated concussions. There is good evidence that there is some permanent effect from a single head injury, even if there has not been an actual loss of consciousness. He went on to say, if there are further injuries, the loss accumulates and eventually there is sufficient impairment of function for everyday activities, social and business, to be affected. In our practice with several thousands of patients with the late effects of mild head injury, there is significant numbers of such people, some of them injured by repeated concussion at rugby football. Wrightson ended his paper with 5 recommendations for the rugby authorities. Firstly, that after any form of concussion, players should not return to play for 3 weeks. Secondly, after a second concussion in one season, they should not play again that season. Thirdly, after a total of 3 concussions, they should leave contact sports. Fourthly, concussions resulting from other sports or accidents should be taken into consideration. And finally, should a player contest the decision to restrict play, an appeal system with formal neuropsychological testing would be available. So, by 1992, 30 years ago, the leaders of rugby union around the world had been made aware of the long-term dangers of head injuries. Yet within a few years after that, International Rugby Union was walking back from this understanding and actually reducing the stand-down time for players with head injuries. So what had changed in the meantime? In part 2, we'll look at what happened over the next decade and examine why Rugby Union abandoned its previous understanding of the importance and dangers of head injuries. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. My Twitter handle is @ColinsTony and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find the complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, together with the show notes for this episode. Until next week, thanks for listening.